I'm Mike Malevsky, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Hollis French, who's on the Democratic ballot for Lieutenant Governor in the August 19th primary. Well, Hollis, thank you for being available today.
Hey, I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your Valley listeners.
We've been working on a general theme, which we've applied to many candidates, and that is, how well do you work with others? Or rather, how do you work with others? And the background to that question is that both nationally and here in Alaska, there seems to have developed a more than usual political polarization. That's resulted in gridlock and decisions made by use of power that isn't always backed by a majority of citizens. So we have a set of four questions. And the first one is, how do you view the present state of government? And the second part to that, how do you work with others of different perspectives, both within and without your own party?
Great. You know, I think, you know, it's interesting. I don't think there's been a time of greater polarization nationally in our lifetimes. You know, I'm a child of the 1960s. I was born in 1958 and grew up just outside of Washington, D.C., and so my family was kind of a politically oriented family. I remember the marches on Washington for civil rights. I remember, Nixon resigning. I remember, you know, some of those pivotal moments of that era up until, the first president I ever voted for was Jimmy Carter, 1976. I turned 18 and helped elect Jimmy Carter, and frankly didn't vote for another successful presidential candidate for a long time until 1992 when Bill Clinton got elected. But, you know, I don't remember this level of vitriol back and forth from one party to the other. I think that's a fairly recent phenomenon that is unfortunate on the national level, where you just, you know, where there's a death penalty inflicted in the primary process on any Republican who dares to cooperate with a Democrat. It's become a sort of there's a purity test and ideological tests that are really unfortunate. Here in Alaska, I think it's different, and it's different mainly because of the recent experiments we've had in the bipartisan coalition in the Senate. I was elected to the Senate in 2002, and it was a partisan place to go to work in 2003, 4, 5, and 6, those first 4 years. The Senate was divided 12-8 in those years, 12 Republicans, 8 Democrats, and every hard vote there was would come down to a 12-8 vote, whether it was reducing the availability of Denali kid care, whether it was zeroing out the science and technology foundation's money. Many of those votes were 12-8 votes, and that was unfortunate. But then, you know, then came the coalition. In 2006, we elected Joe Thomas over Ralph Seekins in Fairbanks, and you know, I think historians will look back at that election as being an extremely pivotal one in the history of the state. That brought the state Senate to 11-9. And when the 11 Republicans could not agree amongst themselves as to who should be the next Senate president, a faction of them came to the Democrats, shook our hands, and 9 Democrats and 5 Republicans formed and then another one joined later on. Another Republican joined later on, formed a 15-member ruling bipartisan coalition that lasted for 6 years. And that, the emanations of that, I think, persisted even into this session, where you frequently saw on tough issues one or two moderate Republicans joining Democrats to stop some of the most conservative ideas we saw coming through the legislature, like vouchers, like the court packing plan of Pete Kelly's, like HB 77.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an interesting example. So, specifically for yourself, how do you? I know that you've outlined the context pretty nicely, but how do you view people who have different perspectives within your party as well as without?
You know, that's a constant in life, right? It's not just politics, but constant in life, right? We, you know, there's just no other person with whom you're going to agree 100% of the time. And so one of the key things you do is you never make it personal. right? You never make it personal.
Okay.
You never, it's actually, you get that training through, for, at least for me, through the rules of engagement that we live by in the Senate under debate. You never speak directly to another member under debate. You always speak to the chair, the presiding officer. In our case, it's the Senate president. And when you refer to another member, you never use their name. You say the senator from District M or the senator from Sitka, and so you don't use names. And that you're not allowed to question someone's motives, right? That's out of bounds. You're allowed to attack the evidence, and you can attack it as hard as you possibly can. But it's out of bounds to drag personalities into the debate, and that's wise. It's wise for a lot of reasons, because in a small Senate like we have, a 20-member Senate, you might be going at somebody as hard as you can possibly go at them one day, but the next day you might be able to work together on something you agree on. And so why burn a bridge that you want to turn around and build the next day? Just don't burn the bridge in the first place.
Okay.
So I think keeping personalities out of the debate and keeping motives out of the debate is just healthy for a dialogue. And here's a way it manifests itself in this oil tax debate that's just raging across the state. People often accuse, I'm a yes on one person, I'm going to be voting yes, and people often accuse us of hating the oil industry. And they're really impugning our motives, right? They're going past the facts and just saying, well, you people just hate the oil industry. And that's not productive. First of all, it's not true. And second of all, it doesn't really shed any light on the question, and it drags you into this morass of, saying, well, who's kissing up the industry and who hates the oil industry, and that doesn't solve any question. And so you can see, by taking that off the table, you can have a nice fact-based debate on, what kind of investment we're getting, how many jobs we're getting, what sort of throughput we're getting through the pipeline, without getting down in the mud of personal motives.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Here in Alaska, going to the second question, there's been a considerable focus on balancing resource development of extractive industries with environmental concerns. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on this particular topic?
That's a really great question. Obviously Alaska is pro-development, and we're given at statehood the mineral resource wealth of the state to sustain ourselves with. So for the foreseeable future, we're going to be a resource extraction state. That being said, we're also a state where every single one of us, with maybe a few exceptions, I guess there's out there, love to see wild salmon, to catch wild salmon, and to eat wild salmon. And so, you have to always keep in mind that the long-term future, beyond any resource extraction, is wild salmon coming back to our waters. So, in any time you have to make a hard choice, you got to default towards salmon. You got to default towards clean water, towards a habitat that will allow those fish to swim free in our waters. So, I think that's the baseline. I think that's why you ultimately saw HB 77 fail.
Mm-hmm.
Even a very pro-development state, a pro-development legislature, sort of woke up at the last minute. The bill, the people who voted for that bill in the House should be ashamed of themselves, because it was, the most anti-public involvement version of the bill passed the House. We kept watering it down in the Senate, and it couldn't get watered down enough to get 11 votes. Even at the very end, the last compromise version was still too heavily weighted against public process, too heavily weighted against clean water and wild salmon to get 11 votes in the Senate, which really says a lot.
Okay, so you've been focusing on your answer and the use of public process in this, and the questions that arrive at our doorstep regarding resource development or environmental concerns. Do you want to expand any more about other aspects of how those questions are best worked at?
Well, let me take a stab at it and see if it gets at what you're asking. The other way of looking at it is that when you sell a resource and when you extract a resource from the state, you only get to sell it once and it's gone forever, especially with respect to mineral resources. And that's why I've been so staunch in favor of keeping a fair oil tax on the books and voting yes on one. The oil we sell today is gone forever. Our children, our grandchildren, their children never get to sell that barrel of oil again. And the best way I treat them fairly is to make sure I keep a fair oil tax on the books and use that money to benefit society as a whole through education, through roads, through infrastructure, through renewable energy projects that keep Alaska humming into the future.
Okay. Thank you. Third question. Edward J. Snowden's actions have led to a widespread discussion, continuing one in today's media, about another balance, that between privacy and security. And the often overlooked aspect of the Snowden affair is the role of media in reporting about or deferring to government activities. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on this topic, specific to the role of media and government?
You know, that's interesting. You know, there's a lot of powerful forces at work there. The First Amendment probably being the most salient. You know, the United States Constitution says Congress shall make no law respecting the freedom of the press. And it's a very, you know, sort of strong, blanket, seemingly exception-free statement. And as a law student, we confront the First Amendment, and you're in the same class in which they introduced the First Amendment. They start talking about, well, is it okay to ban people from shouting fire in a crowded theater? And 99% of the world agrees that yes, you should not be able to shout fire in a crowded theater. But it also, you know, it should animate the discussion throughout. A free press has the ability and has almost the mandate to constantly work to expose the doings of government. You know, it's certainly as powerful a check on government overreach as the Second Amendment is, right? You know, that you can fire a shot around the world by posting something on the internet a lot faster than a bullet will travel. And so I think, you know, you just have to keep the First Amendment in mind as you talk about these questions. You know, Alaska has an explicit right to privacy, something that most states don't other have. It's Article 1, Section 22, the right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. It was put on the books in 1972. So we've been a leader nationally and internationally in respecting people's right to privacy, and certainly Alaskans embrace that, right? I mean, the right to be let alone is one of the most fundamental rights. And we've made it explicit. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about this, and I'd be happy to have more discussion, but those are some of the first thoughts that come to mind.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, it's an entirely separate and probably lengthy discussion. Going on to our fourth question, the Supreme Court has recently taken stands that seem to put corporations above individuals. In Alaska, that may be one aspect underlying the discussion of the role oil companies play in our owner state. How do you view corporations?
Well, I mean, I view corporations the way you view a lot of things. I mean, they're entities that, you know, operate in the world. But the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, I think, is going to be looked back on by historians as this enormous legal mistake, as this enormous misunderstanding of what the principles of free speech really mean. I think Citizens United, in a perverse way, equated money with speech, and that is anathema to American democracy. My speech as a human being should, at some level, be equal with yours and everybody else's, and we should compete with one another on that basic level of equality. But to give Exxon the power of speech commensurate with their financial might is to push me down into the mud and put me so far below them in terms of political power as to make me nearly insignificant. It's just a horrific misunderstanding, I think, of the First Amendment and of what the founding fathers meant when they wrote the Constitution. And so I think ultimately the Supreme Court will come to its senses and right this wrong. But imagine what the landscape would be right now in this state if the oil industry had to pay a maximum of $500 a person towards supporting opposing this repeal effort. Three contributors, BP, Conoco, and Exxon, with a few other folks chipping in, big corporations have come up with $15 million to come up against, the few of us on the other side who are actually contributing our own money. I think I heard in a debate the other night that there have been a total of 9 individuals who have contributed to the No on One campaign. 9 individuals. That's just shocking to me. But it shouldn't be surprising. I guess on another level, it's not surprising. Why should I throw in my money if Exxon's going to put theirs in? Let them do it. But it really shows how out of whack our First Amendment doctrine is right now. And I look forward to a time when it's corrected, because it's producing a state in which the oil industry is in danger of being allowed to buy an election. And they're not in danger of it, but we as a state are in danger of having them buy this election.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Hollis, thank you for being available today.
Hey, I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your Valley listeners.
Okay.
And I am up for election on the 19th, and I'd appreciate, I'm asking for the people who are listening, asking for their vote.
All right. Thank you for running for public office.
Take care now.
Have a good day.
You too.